Kia ora and good evening. For those of you who do not know me, my name is Harlene Hain, and I have the great privilege of being the Vice Chancellor here at the University of Otago. On behalf of the university, it is my great pleasure to welcome everyone who is here this evening. It's fantastic to see staff and students from the University of Otago, and it's also fantastic to see people from the community who are also coming to support Kate tonight on her big evening. I'd also like to acknowledge two members of Kate's family who are in the audience this evening. Her partner is here, as well as her sister. And the fact that these have become family affairs, I think, is a very clear indication of the importance of being promoted to professor here at the University of Otago. We are here tonight to celebrate Kate Scott's promotion to professor and to give her the opportunity to share with us some of her fantastic research findings. I just want to remind people in the audience how difficult it is to become a professor here at Otago. In order to reach this milestone, you must show excellence in teaching, in research, and in service to the university and the broader community. And clearly, Professor Scott has met those milestones. She is internationally recognized for her work on the interplay between mental health and comorbid physical health. She's received substantial prior support from the HRC for her research. She currently has, as of Sunday, over 4,000 citations to her work and an H index over 30. She's also a fantastic teacher, particularly in terms of behavioral science teaching within the school, Dunedin School of Medicine, where she holds full responsibility for the curriculum, for the course planning, assessment, and allocation of teaching. And she's also excelled in terms of service. Professor Scott is a member of the University of Otago Health Ethics Committee. She is also the associate editor of Cardiovascular Psychology and Neurology, and she represents New Zealand on the World Health Organization's World Mental Health Surveys Consortium. In closing, I would also like to note that Professor Scott is a great example of the value of a broad education. Although her final degree is from Cambridge, she also has first degrees in an honors degree in psychology and a BA in English literature. And I think that that's a great example for the way in which we must continue to fiercely defend the broad level of education that is available here to our students at the University of Otago, no matter what field they ultimately end up studying. So on behalf of the University of Otago, I would like to warmly congratulate you, Professor Scott, on your well-earned promotion. And I would like to call on the Dean of the Dunedin School of Medicine, Professor Barry Taylor, to tell us just a little bit more about your journey in getting here.
So it's my pleasure to further introduce Kate Scott. I usually, before these lectures, interview the person, and so I had that pleasure yesterday to sit down with Kate and stand up with Kate and ask her about her career and how she got to where she's got. And you've heard, and I'm not going to repeat everything that Harlene says. She tells me that she's an introvert and actually doesn't like publicity, and that she started doing a BA in, as you say, English literature in Victoria. And then went overseas and taught overseas in Finland and in Egypt before deciding what she wanted to do. So the breadth started very broad right at the beginning, came back to Victoria and decided that she wanted to do clinical psychology, did the BSc the honours degree in psychology and then an MA in psychology, and then started some practice as a clinical psychologist in the Wellington area. She said that that was the time when research started to attract her. The exposure in that honours year and then doing the master's to research ideas and they're finding out of new ideas, and that she's never really lost interest in that, in the research side of things since that time. In fact, looking at her CV, things grew really from that stage, and her activity in terms of finding out new things really has expanded really from that time as she goes through the rest of her career. So she was exposed to clinical, work as a clinical psychologist, working with a liaison team in Wellington Hospital, so seeing a wide range of people who have psychological issues as well as physical illness. So that started her broad interest ongoing between the mind and the body, and the fact that she would see in that liaison psychiatry sort of situation people who have both chronic ongoing illness, physical illness, and how that relates to mental health and vice versa, as they certainly interrelate in a very real way. So that remains her interest, and you'll see that as she comes to her talk, that she will bring together the physical and the mental health issues that have remained her passion. So the clinical work then morphed into a period with an agency which I actually held in high respect, the Public Health Intelligence Unit at the Ministry of Health, which no longer exists, illustrating that ministry keeps changing. But that was actually a really interesting and good unit. She worked there for 4 years, working on the mental health survey, which she's going to talk quite a lot about today. A period of actually, you know, focused within a Ministry of Health environment on actually survey and linking in with other international surveys that in fact ended up with a similar design so that they could be comparison, leading in fact to her main research area at the moment, which is actually comparison of what happens in different countries, especially in the mental health area. So you can sort of see the progression as she goes, get some work experience in different areas, and how that then becomes relevant to the research questions that she tries to answer. After that period, she then joined the Wellington School, University of Otago, Wellington, as a senior lecturer, and in that time went from a 0.5 appointment to a 0.8 appointment. Continued the interest in the clinical problems that she'd previously been exposed to, and really was there for a 10-year period from 2000 to 2010 before we were recruited here down to the Dunedin School of Medicine to run our behavioural part of the Department of Psychological Medicine, at which stage she was associate professor, and then this year being promoted to professor. So you can see the story evolving of somebody who actually uses the experience that she's had to decide on what she wants to do and to answer the research questions that come up related to her everyday work. She's going to talk today a bit about that mind-body interface, the international studies that I mentioned, and also another interest that she has around gender disparities and what, in fact, might underpin the differences, especially in mental health, between people with different genders. So I'm really looking forward to the talk, and I hope you all are as well. It's a fascinating topic area, and Kate, I invite you to come and give your inaugural address. Thank you very much.
Good evening, everybody, and thank you very much for coming. And thank you to Professor Taylor and Hayne for that very generous introduction. So when we study the epidemiology of mental disorders, what we are doing is measuring the prevalence of disorders, and what that means is the percent of the population who meet the diagnostic criteria for mental disorders at particular points in time. And we look at the distribution of disorders in society, so we look at which socioeconomic groups have higher or lower prevalence of disorders. And we also collect information on the risk factors for disorders so that we can get some sense of how these problems are coming about. Now, we have to do surveys. We have to, you know, achieve all of that through surveys. We can't simply go to treatment data and count the number of people who have been treated for mental disorders, because actually the majority of people meeting the criteria for mental disorders don't seek treatment. So we actually have to go out there and knock on doors and interview people about their mental health. And this is quite challenging to do. So to arrive at kind of statistically robust estimates of prevalence, you need large samples. They need to be representative of the whole country. So in New Zealand, we have to go into the rural areas as well as the urban areas. We need a high response rate. So what that means is of all of the people we approach to take part in the survey, a large proportion have to agree. Because what we know from other research is that the people who are less likely to agree to take part are more likely to have mental disorders. So if we end up with a low response rate, that can bias our prevalence estimates. The interview ends up being long. If you're looking at a lot of mental disorders, as we did in New Zealand, the interviews are very long. So even amongst people who have no mental health problems, the interview usually ends up being 45 minutes or an hour, which means that amongst people who do have mental health problems, the interviews are several hours. It has to be done in person for that reason, because of the length of the interview. You can't just do it over the telephone. And all of this means that these kinds of things are very expensive to do, which is why we do not have a long tradition of them in New Zealand. And in fact, we have only ever done one national survey, that is Te Rauhangaro, the New Zealand Mental Health Survey. The data were collected in 2004, so over the whole of that year we had about 100 interviewers collecting data for the full 12 months, and the results were released in about 2006. We achieved a large sample. It's nearly 13,000. This is actually the single largest face-to-face health survey that's been undertaken in New Zealand. We oversampled Māori and Pacific people relative to their population proportions. And we did achieve a very good response rate, so that's terrific. And, you know, these data are actually getting kind of old, but the Ministry of Health have indicated to me this year that they were this survey was so eye-wateringly expensive to conduct. It's unlikely to be doing another such survey anytime soon, so it's just as well that the data are sound. So just to tell you some of the results from the survey, what we see is in terms of 12-month prevalence. So what 12-month prevalence means, this is the percent of the population meeting diagnostic criteria for any of these disorders at some time in the 12 months prior to interview. So you can see from that the total column, and that 14.8 for any anxiety disorder. So that means that nearly 15% of the New Zealand population met the diagnostic criteria for one of the anxiety disorders that we surveyed at some stage in the prior 12 months. So now that's it's a big percent, and it's quite a big group anxiety disorders. There are 7 different anxiety disorders. So these are things like obsessive compulsive disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, specific and social phobia, panic disorder, agoraphobia, generalized anxiety disorder. These are the anxiety disorders. So the 8% for any mood disorder, this includes depression and bipolar disorder, and depression is the more prevalent. So 5.5% of the New Zealand population meet the criteria for depression in the past 12 months. So depression is actually the single most prevalent disorder in the New Zealand population. Substance use disorder, so what this refers to is alcohol and drug abuse and dependence. A lower prevalence, as you can see, that might come as a surprise. You have to consider that as kind of the tip of the iceberg, really, of our problems with substance use in New Zealand. It's probably a little bit lower than we expected. We think perhaps that the diagnostic threshold ended up being set a little bit too high in terms of the questions that we used. Also, denial is quite a feature of these disorders, particularly in the early years, and that, of course, can affect people's willingness to disclose the problems that they have. Eating disorders, this is anorexia and bulimia, as you can see, very low prevalence, although these are severe disorders. And so any of those disorders, 20.7%, so, you know, 1 in 5 of the New Zealand population meeting the criteria for one of these disorders in the past 12 months. So, you know, that's quite a significant proportion. And that's the 12-month prevalence, because actually if we look to the lifetime prevalence or lifetime risk of having a disorder, then it's more like 40 to 50%. Now, schizophrenia is not there. Some of you may be noticing that, or the psychotic disorders generally, and that is because we were sampling the non-institutionalised population of New Zealand, and a lot of people with schizophrenia live in the kinds of institutions that would not have been part of our sampling frame, so that would have kind of biased our estimates. But we know from other research that the prevalence of schizophrenia is quite similar to eating disorders. It's probably around about 0.5% or a bit less, so it wouldn't have made a big difference to the overall prevalence. Now, 2 interesting patterns to note there in this table. One is the age pattern. So what we can see is that the prevalence of mental disorders decreases with increasing age. This is not a novel finding. This is a standard finding. We've found the same thing in many surveys of this type. You know, this is really the good news secret about aging. I think this is not well understood. You know, it's no doubt that physical health deteriorates as you get older, and unfortunately, probably cognitive health as well. So certainly the prevalence of cognitive disorders like dementia goes up with increasing age, but mental health problems don't. And in fact, there's, you know, there's quite a lot of experimental psychology research to kind of back that up, where age-related differences have been observed in the kinds of things that we choose to pay attention to as we age, and the way we react to things, changes that are probably protective of our mental health. The gender differences too, I just want to point out, so you can see there that, that women have higher rates of anxiety disorders and of mood disorders. It's actually just of depression, not bipolar disorder. That's about equal in men and women, but women have higher rates of depression. And I'm going to come back to those gender differences a little bit later in my talk. Men have higher rates of substance use disorders, which won't come as any surprise, and women have higher rates of eating disorders. And just one other table from the New Zealand survey, just to look at the kind of distribution of disorders across society, because this is actually, you know, really important information to take on, I think. So when we look at the prevalence of any 12-month disorder, you can see that it is somewhat higher amongst people with less education. And we have ways of classifying disorders by severity, so we were able to sort of determine, we're able to categorise the disorders as either severe or moderate or mild. And when we just look at the people with severe disorders, you can see that that kind of disparity across education groups is even more pronounced amongst people with severe disorders. And the same pattern for income. So the prevalence of any disorder is higher amongst people with lower income, and that pattern is further accentuated amongst people with severe disorders, when there's, where there's really quite a discrepancy. Now, in terms of ethnicity, you know, the Ministry of Health, before they funded the survey, had been extremely worried because the anecdotal evidence had suggested that possibly Māori were going to have much higher rates of mental disorder. They do have higher rates, as you can see, but not much higher. So somewhat higher in terms of the prevalence of any 12-month disorder, but, you know, again, a slightly greater discrepancy between Māori and the rest of the population when you look at just severe disorders. Now, these prevalence estimates are adjusted for age and sex. When we additionally adjust those ethnic-specific prevalences for income and for education, some of that difference between Māori and the rest of the population diminishes, but not all. So there are still, Māori still have significantly higher prevalence of disorders. Now, this New Zealand survey was part of an international collaboration called the WHO World Mental Health Surveys Initiative. And the aim of this big global project was to provide information on the cross-national epidemiology of mental disorders using a standardised methodology, because this had never really been done before. And particularly, the aim was to try and get information on the epidemiology of disorders in developing countries, because really we knew almost nothing about that, apart from isolated surveys in a few countries. And the way this kind of standardised approach was achieved was that Michigan University took the lead. Michigan University are the kind of world leaders in survey research methodology, and they sent people out to each of the contributing countries and trained the interviewers, as they did in New Zealand as well, and basically had a close eye on in terms of the quality control of the data collection. And what I should just say is that this is actually an ongoing project. So we didn't have 31 countries initially. It started about 15 years ago, and countries have been sort of joining the World Mental Health Surveys collaboration as time has gone on. So we're now up to 31 countries. And Michigan also sort of helped negotiate some of the quite considerable difficulties in terms of the data collection. I mean, you know, the data collection was actually quite challenging in New Zealand, but nothing compared to what it was like collecting data in some of those developing countries. Iraq, for example, is one of the World Mental Health Surveys, and the data collection there coincided with the American invasion, which put a stop to things temporarily. But then, you know, they carried on and they finished the data collection, which is quite remarkable. A number of other countries like Colombia and Mexico and some of the other developing countries had particular problems because, you know, in New Zealand, the interviewers used laptop computers to enter the, all of the respondents' data, which made things much more streamlined. But in those countries, the interviewers couldn't carry around laptop computers because it put them at great personal risk of being mugged. So they had to resort to using paper-based questionnaires, you know, like about, it's about this thick, the paper-based questionnaire, so much more complicated. So many, many logistical hurdles to overcome. The overall project management and all of the analytical side was handled through Harvard medical school under the direction of the overall principal investigator, Ron Kessler. So whenever a country finished collecting their data, it went off to Harvard where it got cleaned and coded. That's a kind of massive job in itself. And Harvard ran all of the diagnostic algorithms and produced the prevalence estimates. Now, I'm just showing you here the results from the first 17 of the countries to join the collaboration, because if I put all the countries up there, the slide gets quite messy. So you can see that the United States has the highest prevalence. So that, you know, this is 12-month prevalence of any disorder. And you remember that New Zealand's 20.7%. So the United States with 27%, Ukraine up next, primarily driven by their very high rates of substance use disorders, which, you know, any of you have kind of followed what's happened to their use of alcohol after the breakup of the Soviet Union won't be surprised at that. Colombia next highest, and New Zealand pretty high too, and I'll come back to that shortly. And then if you look at the sort of the other end of the table, you see Nigeria, which really came as a surprise, I think, to all of us, because, you know, when you just think about the kind of news items that we hear about in Nigeria, with sort of hundreds of schoolgirls being kidnapped and so on, I mean, Nigeria does not strike you as likely to be a sort of mental health paradise. So what is going on? And the kind of short and unsatisfactory answer to that question is we don't know as to what can really be explaining the variation in prevalence across countries. So, I mean, the aim of the World Mental Health Surveys was to standardize methodology so that we would be able to then interpret any variation across countries in prevalence in terms of real variation, for example, in the risk factors for mental disorders. Hasn't quite worked out that way, though, because methodological variation always tends to kind of creep in. And one of the things that I think has probably happened is that there's this sort of interaction between methodology and culture in some countries that has influenced results. So Nigeria, for example, you know, there's been a lot of discussion with the Nigerian principal investigator as to what could be going on, could account for the very low prevalence of disorders in that country. And he said, well, you know, we don't have a tradition of doing this kind of survey in Nigeria. So when somebody from the government comes knocking on the door of people wanting to interview them about their mental health, you know, people are probably not only a bit startled by that, but possibly quite threatened. And that really may affect their willingness to disclose the problems that they have. And something similar might be going on in the Asian countries, Japan and China, although these have traditionally had low rates of mental disorder. But again, you know, those countries are known for mental disorders being quite highly stigmatized, this need to kind of keep face, and possibly that also dampens down the prevalence estimates there. So there's probably methodological variation, which is partly explaining the difference across countries, but there might also be real variation. So let me just touch on New Zealand again. New Zealand does, unfortunately, have high rates of some of the known risk factors for mental disorders. And one of those is childhood adversities, child maltreatment or child abuse, where unfortunately we're amongst the highest amongst OECD countries in that. And that is a very well-established risk factor for the development of mental disorders. New Zealand also has high rates of teen binge drinking and drug use. These are risk factors not only for the development of substance use disorders, but for all of the mental disorders. New Zealand in recent years also is quite high in terms of income inequality, and that is now established by both our data and other studies as a risk factor for mental disorders. So, you know, this might be part of the reason why New Zealand's ending up rather high there. Okay, I'm going to move now from talking about the New Zealand survey in particular, and on to talking about two of the areas that I've had the opportunity to explore using the World Mental Health data. And I am going to come on to mental physical links, but just a little bit later, because I've always had an interest in the gender difference in mental disorders, and I'm just focusing on depression here. So, you know, as I mentioned in the New Zealand data, women have higher rates of depression. Now, that is an absolute bog standard finding. It has been found in hundreds and hundreds of studies. And when it was first observed, probably about 40 years ago, it gave rise to what's termed the gender roles hypothesis. So this was the idea that maybe women's higher rates of depression could be because they have sort of fewer opportunities and perhaps less satisfying opportunities career-wise and otherwise in terms of their adult social roles than men. now, and you know, as was perhaps the case some 40 years ago. That hypothesis has kind of fallen, or had rather fallen out of favour for two reasons. One is because social change has meant that actually women have much greater opportunities now, and there's more kind of equality with men in terms of social roles and career opportunities than there used to be. But it's also because there is now much more prominence of strong kind of biological hypotheses, biological explanations for the gender difference in depression. And the most prominent of these being that perhaps the gender difference in depression is a function of sex hormone differences. So differences across men and women in the way sex hormones influence mood. An inconvenient finding, though, for the biological hypothesis has been observed in a number of studies, and including our data, and that is that in recent times, that gender difference seems to be diminishing. So there's been this kind of narrowing of the gender difference in depression over time, so that it's smaller in recent cohorts compared to older cohorts. Now, you can't explain that kind of variation over time in terms of biology. And on the face of it, it would seem that, you know, the gender roles hypothesis might be quite a good explanation for it, if it's the case that, you know, societal changes have led to greater opportunities for women. Perhaps this is why this gender difference is diminishing. But nobody had really been able to test that possibility because they didn't really have the right kind of data. And we devised a way of looking at this in the World Mental Health data. And the way we did this was we took the information from participants and we worked out what the gender differences were in terms of education, in terms of income, in terms of age at first marriage. And we worked that out for four different age groups within each country. And we put that information together with information from female participants on the use of birth control. And from all of that, we constructed a measure of gender role equality that we were able to use to determine the degree of gender role equality operating within each country at different time points in their recent history. When we'd done all of that, which took about a year, this was quite a complex analysis, we were then in a position to test this hypothesis. And what we found was that that narrowing of the gender difference in depression over time was strongly associated with increasing gender role equality within countries over the same period of time. So that was a very interesting finding, I think, and I'm going to come back to it briefly in just a minute. But it led on to a related question in my mind about marriage, because, you know, especially amongst feminists, there's been a lot of discussion about the idea that perhaps, you know, marriage in modern societies like New Zealand, you know, marriage is perhaps a sort of bastion of gender role traditionality. So I was interested in looking at whether or not there was any association between marriage and the development of mental disorders. Now, I don't know why you all laugh, but anyway. I just need to make a brief comment about methodology because, you know, some of you who are researchers will be perhaps wondering. So, I mean, the best way of looking at the kind of sequence of events, like, for example, the effect of marriage on subsequent mental disorders, the best way of doing that is to use prospective data where you follow people over time. And that's not the kind of data we have here. We have cross-sectional surveys, so it's cross-sectional data. However, we have collected information on the timing of the key events that we want to look at the sequencing of. So we have information on the age of marriage, on the age at first onset of mental disorders, on the age of if people got divorced, when that was, the age of widowhood, and so on. Now, our data are not as good as prospective data because we're relying on people's recall, so there's lots of opportunity for error and for bias. However, we have a very large data set, and that gives us some advantages. You know, we're now up to about 150,000 participants in the World Mental Health Surveys, probably 50 to 100,000 participants for some of these earlier papers. So what that means is that we're able to tackle some research questions that other studies, prospective studies with their smaller samples, haven't been able to tackle. And the relationship between marriage and mental health is a case in point, because when you are thinking about what the effect of marriage might be, there are sort of two possible comparisons you can make. You can compare people who are currently married with people who are never married, or you can compare people who are currently married with people whose marriages have ended in divorce or by widowhood. And it's only really the latter kind of study that had been done, that comparison of marriage with divorce. And really, they'd only looked at depression as an outcome. They hadn't really looked at the other 15 or 16 mental disorders that we're interested in. So with the World Mental Health data, we were able to look at the relationship between marriage and mental disorders in a much more kind of comprehensive way. So just to very briefly summarise what we knew already. So what we knew already actually is that marriage is good for physical health. So, you know, that seems to be quite well established. So, you know, husbands and wives sort of encourage each other in positive health behaviours or nag each other or, you know, whatever it is, it seems to be working anyway in promoting physical health. But for mental health, though, the situation was less clear. There were quite a few studies that suggested that marriage was good for men's mental health. But for women, the data were much more conflicting. In fact, there were some studies that suggested that marriage had the opposite effect and was inclined to increase the risk of depression. So what we found, and I'm just summarising an awful lot of analysis here, we found that being married compared to people who either were never married or who were once married and then divorced, separated or widowed, we found that being married was associated with reduced risk of first onset of nearly all mental disorders for both men and women. So a generally protective effect of marriage for mental health. However, for depression and for panic disorder, we found that this risk reduction only occurred in men. There was just a kind of neutral effect for women. So it wasn't that marriage increased risk of depression for women or decreased it. It was just kind of neutral. What was interesting, though, is that when we broke, because this is all countries combined, when we broke the countries up into two groups, into developing countries and into developed countries, we found that if we just looked at developed countries like, you know, New Zealand and the United States, that actually marriage was associated with reduced risk of depression for women as well as men. It wasn't as strong an effect for women, but it was there, so reduced risk for women. But in the developing countries, we found the opposite. So there, marriage was actually associated with increased risk of depression for women and reduced risk of depression for men. Again, an interesting finding, I think, you know, really quite consistent with what we were seeing in the gender role equality paper. And collectively, I think that, you know, these findings from these papers are a really important reminder in this day and age where biological hypotheses are pushed so strongly, an important reminder that social factors and relationships amongst those social factors can be critically important in shaping the likelihood of developing mental disorders for men and for women. Okay, I'm going to move now and talk about my kind of second area of interest and just preface this by a few remarks about the impact of mental disorders. So we've done lots of research, other people have too, looking at the short-term impact of mental disorders. And the way we look at this is to assess the impact that mental disorders have on people's ability to function in their everyday lives. So it's called functional impairment. And what we've found in both the New Zealand data and has been found in many other studies, that actually the associated functional impairment of mental disorders is substantially greater than the functional impairment people experience when they have chronic physical conditions like diabetes or heart disease. It's the long-term impact that I've been interested in looking at, though. And again, we've done quite a lot of research on this in the World Mental Health Surveys. It's been summarised in the book that you see there. The reason that mental disorders have such great long-term impact is because when they occur in the lifespan. So these are early onset disorders. So the median age, if you just consider all disorders, sort of average across all mental disorders, the median age of onset is 18. It's a little bit older for some of the disorders. So for depression, one or two of the anxiety disorders, it's more, the median age of onset is more into the 20s. But for some of the anxiety disorders, it's actually in childhood. So with that early onset comes the capacity for severe and persistent disorders to have a really profound influence on the total kind of life trajectory, if you like, of the people experiencing those disorders. So mental disorders can influence the capacity to get into relationships or to maintain relationships, people's ability to achieve their educational outcomes or to take up educational opportunities, to get into particular jobs, the careers that they pursue, to work at all. And so have a flow-on effect, of course, into financial and socioeconomic status. So really quite a profound long-term effect. What I was particularly interested in looking at, though, is whether there might be another long-term effect that was less well understood, and that is whether mental disorders might actually increase the risk of developing chronic physical conditions later in life. Now, I was funded by the HRC in this project. So prior to starting this project, which was about 5 years ago, what we knew at that time, we definitely knew that psychotic disorders like schizophrenia were associated with poor physical health outcomes. I mean, that's, part of that is because of the antipsychotic medication that they have to take, but it's not just that. So that was very clear. What was also clear is that there was a specific link between depression and heart disease, because there had been quite a few prospective studies on heart disease trying to work out what the risk factors for heart disease were, and they usually included measures of depression symptoms, not usually disorder, but certainly symptoms, and they kept finding an association between elevated depression symptoms and the likelihood of actually getting heart disease or having a heart attack or dying from heart disease. So there was actually intense interest in this particular association between depression and heart disease. I mean, researchers really, once this link was discovered, they just kind of fell on it, and there have just been hundreds of studies looking at this, what the kind of mechanisms might be linking depression and heart disease. Now, this bothered me because I felt that the broader epidemiological picture hadn't been looked at. So we didn't really know, for example, whether depression might be associated with a much wider range of chronic physical conditions other than heart disease. And we also didn't know whether other mental disorders besides depression might be related to heart disease and many other chronic physical conditions. And it struck me that, you know, if that was true, if there was this much broader network, that really had quite important public health and clinical implications and might mean that, you know, all of the research dollars being thrown into this particular link between depression and heart disease might be a bit premature. So, just to reiterate, so no general populations means, in other words, there had been one or two clinical studies, but certainly no general population study of whether this wide range of mental disorders might be linked with a wide range of chronic physical conditions. So that's what we set out to look at. We looked at associations between 16 mental disorders and the subsequent diagnosis of these 11 chronic physical conditions. And, I mean, one of the things I didn't make clear, actually, when I was talking about the methodology, is that because we have the information on the timing of these events, what it means is that we can do statistical analyses, the same kinds of statistical analyses that you would undertake with prospective data to look at the sequencing of events. And that allowed us, in this case, to do analyses looking at whether having a prior mental disorder increased your risk of subsequent diagnosis of one of these chronic physical conditions. Because, I mean, these are mental health surveys that we have, but we did include some information. We collected some information from participants in whether or not they had ever been diagnosed by a physician with one of these chronic physical conditions and when, what year that was, if they had been so diagnosed. So that enabled us to do these kind of sequential analyses. So what we found is that as kind of expected, or as I anticipated, was that in fact a really wide range of mental disorders were associated with increased risk of subsequent diagnosis of a very wide range of physical conditions. So depression was not just associated with heart disease, it was associated with all 11 of the chronic physical conditions that we were looking at. And in fact, the depression-heart disease link was actually the weakest, one of the weakest of the ones that we saw, although it was statistically significant. We also found that the more mental disorders somebody experiences over the life course, especially the more types of different mental disorders, the greater the risk of subsequent physical ill health. And I mean, we saw a kind of dose-response relationship there in terms of the number of disorders people experience and the likelihood of being diagnosed with a chronic physical condition later on. We also found that the earlier the onset of the mental disorder, the greater the risk of being diagnosed with a physical condition later. So these last two, the number of disorders, the earlier the onset, these are kind of markers of the severity of psychopathology. So it's not surprising that these are linked with greater risk of physical conditions later. Now, just before I go on to talk about the implications, just very briefly, because you know we don't really have the data to show this, but some people will be wondering, how is it that mental disorders can increase the risk of chronic physical conditions? So really two main pathways. The first of this is a behavioural pathway, because we know that people with mental disorders tend to have poorer health-related behaviour. We actually had information on smoking, and we controlled for smoking in our analysis, so it's not just that, but these other behaviours may well be involved. There are many biological pathways too that have been suggested. So we also know that people with mental disorders have higher stress hormones, because having a mental disorder is kind of like experiencing chronic stress. So higher stress hormones, higher levels of inflammation, and oxidative stress. And you know these things underpin chronic physical conditions, quite a wide range of conditions. And there are also healthcare pathways that I'm going to talk about a little bit more in just a minute, but essentially there can be differences in the way people with and without mental disorders are treated in the physical healthcare system. So the implications from our study, I think, are that we need early detection and treatment of mental disorders. And I mean, if we do manage to achieve that, if we have earlier detection and better treatment of mental disorders, then we've got a real opportunity for influencing the primary prevention of chronic physical conditions. Now, I mean, many of us have been lobbying for the early detection and treatment of mental disorders for a wide range of reasons, for all the obvious reasons like the suffering that they cause and the elevation of suicide risk. But here is another reason in terms of the possibility of preventing later chronic physical conditions. And this is a reason that I'm hoping that policymakers will sit up and take notice of, because actually it's the chronic physical conditions that really are the costly thing in terms of the healthcare system. Treatment of mental disorder, I think, has to be accompanied by assessment of health behaviours and of biomarkers, the biomarkers for the chronic physical conditions like blood pressure and high cholesterol and so on. Now that does not systematically happen. You might think that it would happen, but actually it's kind of almost like the opposite. Once people get a diagnosis of a mental disorder, they're actually less likely to be evaluated in terms of health behaviours and these health biomarkers. Perhaps, I mean, I don't mean to imply that GPs are being neglectful, but I think it's kind of like, you know, once people have been diagnosed with something like depression, I think GPs often think, well, you know, that's really the priority and I don't want to bother them now by talking about, you know, their smoking or their diet and so on. And so I understand how that's happening, but I think, unfortunately, you know, we're kind of failing patients there. Another implication is that we actually need to be doing this parallel focus on the physical health of people with mental health problems, even in young people with mental disorders. And this is just not happening for sort of understandable reasons, because I think people tend to think, well, you know, young people are in the prime of their lives physically. And, you know, relatively speaking, that's true. But what we also know from a lot of research now is actually the beginnings or the pathogenesis of chronic physical conditions actually are evident very early in life. So, you know, autopsy studies have shown us that atherosclerosis, which underpins coronary heart disease, is evident there even in late childhood and in the teens. And finally, you know, the implication of my study is that we need to be assessing physical health for all mental disorders, not just psychotic disorders. And again, this just isn't happening. So to the extent that there is a parallel focus on the physical health of people with mental disorders, this is presently just confined to people with schizophrenia and very occasionally people with bipolar disorder. It's certainly not happening for people with all of those other disorders, which are much more prevalent. And we've published about 15 papers from this project, so there's much more detail than I've been able to present to you here, but I was very pleased that the final sort of overview paper, which summarises these findings and in which I draw out these implications, was accepted for publication just last week by a very good journal, JAMA Psychiatry, and that gives me hope that maybe somebody at least will pay attention to the findings. Okay, I'm moving on to finish my talk, but I just wanted to make some brief acknowledgements and to acknowledge the people who have really kind of helped me in my career. And the first of these is Emeritus Professor Elizabeth Wells, who was the bias statistician for the New Zealand Mental Health Survey. And, you know, we were enormously fortunate in New Zealand to have somebody of Elizabeth's expertise and calibre. I don't know that we could have done that survey without her. Mike von Korff, who was really my mentor in my early years of looking at mental physical comorbidity prior to the HRC grant, has been hugely helpful. And Professor Ron Kessler, who is, you know, really the brilliant mind and the driving force behind the World Mental Health Surveys. I mean, I think Ron is your typical kind of overworked, overburdened Harvard academic, but he has nonetheless found the time to provide me with a great deal of statistical help and input and critical feedback on my work, and I'm hugely grateful for that. I also want to acknowledge Carmen Lim, who is in the audience here. Carmen is my biostatistician, has been working with me on the mental physical grant and still works with me now. And, you know, it's thanks to Carmen's hard work and churning out table after table that has enabled me to continue to be productive. And finally, last but not least, I wanted to acknowledge the unflagging support, both practical and emotional, of my partner, Alan Williams. Alan and I met 26 years ago when I returned to university to study psychology, and he was there studying mathematics and education. And I selected this photo because I thought it kind of exemplified what I was telling you before about marriage having a beneficial effect on both physical health, because here we are hiking, and mental health, because we're both smiling. Thank you very much for your attention.
Kate, don't run away, please. I'd like to keep this very brief, but I'm here just to say a couple of words. Firstly, thank you for an outstanding presentation. The slides that you're showing here seem you've boiled down some incredibly complex topics into a series of bullet points, and I think that's a remarkable achievement. And really, the complexity of these bidirectional relationships between mental and physical disorders are extraordinary in their complexity. And I think it's not just looking at a few, say, genetic or environmental effects, that there are social roles, that there are psychological elements that may drive these. So, and I think the ability to explore data sets and come up with these novel and very important findings is incredibly important. It's been wonderful having you as a colleague. I think you've brought a new intellectual rigour to the department. I think you've had a major effect on teaching in the department, and I think you've influenced a lot of people with your research abilities and your own personal qualities. So thank you very much. Congratulations, Professor, and we look forward to great research achievements in the future. Thank you.